So the ultimate purpose, if you don't mind. The reason that we're all gathered here this morning is because we want to grow. We want to grow in our Jewish life. We want to grow in our relationship with Hashem. We want to grow in our Yiddishkeit and our spirituality. We're looking to be ideal, you could say. To set aside time, and I think it's pretty amazing that you look around the room, how many people have set aside time on a Sunday morning where they could be doing lots of other things, setting time for learning and focusing on spiritual and Torah growth. It's amazing. So this represents a concept, and that's the concept that I'd like to explore with you this morning, and that's what we could call lechatchila. Lechatchila is a Hebrew word that means initially or a priori. It means what we would call maybe in modern parlance, best practices. Because there are two ways to be Jewish, there are two ways to do anything. You can do it just for the sake of doing it. You can just get through it. Or, not just the basic practice, but you could seek for the best practice. You could try to strive for something greater than just being average and mediocre. And that's what everybody is here, and it's really amazing, because we're not just looking to be mediocre, we're looking to grow. So what I'd like to explore together with you is to understand to a greater level what that means. And what it means, not in the abstract, but in a very practical sense. You know, if you were to sit back and say, oh, could you create a shiur that would change your life? So I would say, if I was listening to this shiur, in a certain sense, I would say, I would want this shiur to change my life. And I don't expect this shiur is going to change anybody's life. But so often we go through life and we don't have a full appreciation of what it means when we say lechatchila and how that can inspire us and govern our lives, and maybe this will help to that end. So the question is, first of all, why is it important to pursue best practices? Why is lechatchila something that we should value as Jews? So I would say, just by way of introduction, we need to think about our Judaism not as a list of checklists, as a to-do list. It's something more, it's something about a relationship. So the first place to start this year would be a posting from the Huffington Post. What better way to start the series of Bar Makomos on page one. We're not going to go through the whole thing, but there is this woman who is very into, she has a whole blog and an institute for love and all things interesting. So she posted, believe it or not, this past Friday in the Huffington Post, life is in the details. And she describes how so much of what we do and how so much of what is important in our lives is actually found in the details. Because so much of what we're going to talk about of developing Jewish practices is exactly in the details. And you wonder yourself sometimes, like, why does it matter? Like, why does it matter if I do this small difference or that small difference? It's just so small. It's so insignificant, seemingly. And she points out that when it comes to relationships, everything is in the details. You can save it for later. On the bottom, the second to last paragraph. The details of our lives are how we are of service to ourselves, the people who love us, and our hopes. Tell someone how you love through attending to the detail. He or she will surely feel it. The last line is just for everyone else in the room, not for me, especially if she is a mother. If you want to develop a relationship with somebody, it's elementary that you have to attend to the details. It's not just enough to send a thank you card in general or a happy anniversary card that some stock phrase is borrowed from somebody else. You have to put in a little something of yourself in the details. So we think about our relationship with God, Hashem, the living God that goes with us. We're cultivating throughout our life, we're cultivating a relationship. Well, to cultivate that relationship, we need to think about the details. And we need to think about whether or not we're just going through the motions, or we're trying to improve on these small details. That's where lechatchila comes in. You want to do something in the most effective way? Think about the details. Think about doing it in the best possible way. So that's one aspect of it. But there's another aspect that's not just about developing a relationship with Hashem. It's also the steps, the incremental steps that go into a relationship with God. Because each of us, inside of us, we have a neshama, we have a soul. And that soul is connected to the Almighty. Now, we can view it perhaps as an analogy. We can view it as if there's some kind of like umbilical cord. There's some kind of rope. Imagine you go to a shipyard and you see a very thick rope, a cord. And the cord is made up of many, many, many small strands that are spun, woven together. And this is a thick cord that connects us. So to speak, we're going through life, and each of us knows we have this spirit, we have this neshama inside us, and we're connecting to that cord, that source of life. Well, says the great first Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rav Shneur Zalman, in the next page, in page B, which is the introduction, says the Alter Rebbe, you want to understand how our souls are connected to God? It's like a rope, based on the Pasuk, Yaakov Chevel Nachalaso. What does that mean? Vuhu al derech mashal. It is like a parable. Mechevel av. It is a thick rope. Shazur mitaryag chavalim. That is spun with 613 little threads. Dakim. Thin ones. That what? Every kacha chevel hahamshacha hanal kolol mitaryag mitzvos. Every one of us is attached by a rope to the source of our life, to the Almighty, all the time. And through that, we are sustained spiritually. And each one of these threads is a mitzvah. When a person falls short, they take a tiny little snip out of one of those little threads. And when a person does a mitzvah, when we do the mitzvahs bishlei Musa, the proper way, what are we doing? We're strengthening that cord, that spiritual connection that we have to God within us. And very often we feel that. Once in a blue moon, maybe some of the people in this room more inspired than I am, more occasionally than others, we feel something special, we feel some movement, some spiritual development. That's the strengthening, the thickening of the cord, says the Alter Rebbe. So you want to think about Lechatchila, you're right. Imagine you're hanging off the edge of a ship, holding on to a rope, and you're in the middle of the Indian Ocean, and they say, just hold on. And there you are, sitting at the bottom of the boat, and you're just snipping away the thing. You figure out how many cord can you cut until you can manage to get through. That's not a way to live. A way to live is to strengthen that cord, to create the greater energy and the spirit that brings into our lives. So that would be a second way of looking at why we need to think about best practices. So if we turn to the next page as we get started, the Gemara tells us that there are many halachos that govern specific mitzvos. So on page 1, you have a Tosfos. Tosfos is living in France in the 13th century, and they make a following important distinction, that you should understand there are different ways to do mitzvos. There are basic ways, basic practices, and then there are best practices, lechatchila. Tosfos says you should be aware that this exists only when it comes to mitzvos, not when it comes to what's called a matir. So don't get confused, they say. Let's say you have an instance, for example, someone who immerses themselves in a mikvah. So Tosfos says when it comes to a mikvah, either it's kosher or it's not kosher. Either a person is acceptable or not acceptable. That's a matir. Either the animal is kosher or not kosher. The question is, when it comes to a mitzvah, can you have multiple levels of fulfillment? This is Tosfos's suggestion. So Tosfos says, absolutely. And he gives you a few examples. In the bracket here, he says, when it comes to tevilah, and we'll see in a second, it's not so simple what I just said, but this is the basic principle. There, you don't have lechatchila and bidyevet. Bidyevet will translate in a minute. But in the second line, he says, korbanos, bila, mixing a korban, umikra bikurim, v'chalitza, mitzvos ninu, hilkach, lechatchila li'ovad. The end of the bracket. When you do a mitzvah, says Tosfos, the best way to do it is lechatchila, a priori, the best practice. So when you talk about a mitzvah, you're going to do it the best way. Well, how do you figure out, what does it mean to do a mitzvah the best way? I don't understand the whole concept. Okay? Okay. I don't understand the whole concept in the first place. If God gave us a commandment, a mitzvah, so what does it mean that he gave us a mitzvah and then you could do it a better way? It's like a super mitzvah. Like you go to 7-Eleven, you can get 4 kinds of sodas. You can get a gulp, a big gulp, super big gulp, and then a double gulp. Ribbono Shel Olam, I don't know what happens after you drink a double gulp. You ever see one of those things? So how could it be? What does it mean that the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us mitzvos? Thank you. Rachmanis, I feel so much freer now. What does it mean that you can have a mitzvah that has multiple layers of fulfillment? God gave us a thread. He gave us a chevel. And he said, hold on to it. Do the mitzvah. So what does it mean that there are two ways of doing a mitzvah? And this is what we call in halacha, lechatchila, a priori, best practices, and then bidyevet, afterwards. You did it
Okay, I wouldn't have told it to you in the first place to do it that way, but l'chatchila b'diavad. How can you have a l'chatchila b'diavad in a mitzvah? God tells you to do it. Either you did it or you didn't do it. It's binary, isn't it? So we have to understand that it's not always the case. Because we could suggest, and this first idea comes from a great Talmud Chacham based on an insight that he shared years ago, Rav Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg in Yerushalayim, a great, great Talmud Chacham. So he pointed out, he says, look, sometimes mitzvahs have different components to them. So if you look on page 2, the Gemara tells you, in Maseches Menachos, the Mishnah tells you, Dalit minim dalit shebelulav, in the underline, Chav Zayinam Aleph. Va'arba shemitzorah ma'akvin zezeh. The Torah tells you on Sukkos, tells us to take four species, right? A lulav, an esrog, hadasim, and aravos. Says the Mishnah, I might have thought, let's say you only have three. Let's say you don't have any esrog this year, which was sometimes the case in Europe in some communities. So maybe you should say, let me take the other three. So the Gemara says, no, they are ma'akiv zezeh. You have four components, and they are necessary for each other. They're indispensable. If you don't have one, you have none. But that's not the only case. I'll give you an example. This is a talis. And this talis, according to Rav Herzog's initial suggestion and many other poskim today, this talis is what we have, what we think is tchelis. It comes from a snail called the Murex trunculus. So this talis has two kinds of strings on it. This is what we call in halacha. We have lavan and tchelis. And this follows the Tosfos practice, which means that there are four strings, two of them are blue and two of them are white. Well, not every talis of every person has both blue and white strings on them. And even historically, not everybody could afford tchelis, because tchelis was a very expensive material. Well, what's the difference between tchelis and your tzitzis and the four minim shebelulav? So if you look on the next page, the Mishnah tells us, on page 3, ha-tchelis, the blue strings, eino ma'akeves es halavan. It doesn't impede the white strings. V'halavan eino ma'akeves ha-tchelis. They can be separate. You can have one or the other. So now I see something very interesting. You can look at this in two ways. You could say, well, there are two mitzvahs here. There's a mitzvah of blue, and there's a mitzvah of white. And maybe that's why, for Tosfos, you have two and two. Two different channels. But that's not what the Rambam thinks. The Rambam thinks you only have one blue string. This doesn't follow the Rambam. So wait a second. For the Rambam, the simple understanding is it's one mitzvah. So what does it mean? It means you have one mitzvah with two components. What's the best way to do the mitzvah? To have both. That's l'chatchila. If you don't have the best, it's okay with only one. So this is a perfect example of multiple components of a mitzvah. The best way is to do both. But the Torah's chiddush is, the way that the Torah is trying to teach us through the rabbis, is if you don't have both, it's still okay. Another example of this would be on the next page, on page 4. Here says the Mishnah, Maseches Brachos, comes the issue of the recitation of Shema. Hakorei es Shema. A person who recites the Shema, velo hishmia leozno, and didn't hear what he or she was saying. Says the Mishnah, yatza. The anonymous opinion in the Mishnah is the person fulfilled their obligation. And then Rabbi Yossi Omer, lo yatza. He is not in fulfillment of the obligation. What's the machlokas? So perhaps, this is what Rav Zalman Nechemiah said, is pshat, a great pshat. He says, look, we never thought about it this way, but actually there are two components of Kriya Shema. There's the speaking, and there's the listening. Two components. Rabbi Yossi says, both of them are essential. If you just have the speaking and not the listening, you're not Yotze. You did not fulfill your obligation. But according to the first opinion, which is the way we assume Lahalacha, you need only one. You only need the Kriya. So what is it? It means that the mitzvah lechatchila, the mitzvah is to have both components. You should have the speaking and the listening. But b'di'eved, post facto, all you need is the speaking. So this is the first example, number one, how to act lechatchila. It's to fulfill all the different components of any specific mitzvah. That's one. But then, there's another way of looking at lechatchila, and that could be within, let's say, multiple layers of a mitzvah. And I'll give you an example. Anybody here ever slaughter a chicken? An animal? No. I'm the only one? Okay. So it happens to be that when you slaughter an animal, no? Not even in Lincolnwood, they don't shecht animals. No, okay. So when I was in YU, we had a practical Shechita class in the fourth floor library, in the bio lab in MTA. So every week we would have some chickens, we would have dirt. It was gewaltig. I have my own knife at home. I haven't used it since we've come to Chicago. So anybody who's eaten at our house is starting to wonder, like, what was I eating? So the din is, the Gemara says in the beginning of Chulin, on Daf Chav Zayin, that when you shecht the chicken, you only have to shecht one of the simonim, either the kana or the veshet, right? Every animal has a trachea and an esophagus, so when it comes to a chicken, you only slaughter one, and when you have a gasa, a large animal, you have to do two. You have to slaughter both. And those knives are very, very big knives. So the Gemara says, wait a second, the Mishnah says that if a person shechted, slaughtered an animal, so they have to get, let's say for an animal, they have to get both of the simonim, the esophagus and the trachea, but you only require rove 51%. That's it. So the Gemara says, what do you mean, only 51%? Yeah, the Gemara says we have a principle called rubo kukulo. Most of it is like all of it. Now, where does this come from? So we have a Gemara in Maseches Sukkah that tells us when it comes to measurements, these are traditions. Halacha Moshe Misinai. So we have a tradition that when in many areas of halacha, most of it is all of it. Okay. But the Gemara says that is only b'diavad. That's only post facto. If you're a shochet, the best thing to do is to slaughter all of it. B'diavad, you can do most of it. So you can have the same practice. The best practice is to do everything. Lesser than that is to rely on the b'diavad principle of rubo kukulo. Similar, this is going to come up at the Seder, and different people have different practices, but if you look on page 5, the Shulchan Aruch tells us, you sit down to the Dalet Kosos, how much are you going to drink? So drinking Dalet Kosos, the four cups of the Seder, is different than drinking Kiddush, where the person only has to drink a cheekful, malol lugmav. When it comes to Kiddush, it's a different halacha, not for today. But the Shulchan Aruch says, V'yishte kulo o rubo. You should drink the whole cup or most of the cup. Why are you only going to drink most of the cup? We just said there's a principle of rubo kukulo. More, 51%, as if you drank the whole cup. So why does the Shulchan Aruch say all and then most? What would you say? What's that? Best practices is to drink all. And that's what the Taz here, Reb David Halevi, quotes from his father-in-law, the Bach, Reb Yol Circus, in the 17th century in Poland. He says, Mori Chamizal, my father-in-law, in the underline here in the Rashi script, Kulo Lechatchila. It's best to drink the whole thing. So that's why, let's say, at the Pesach Seder, when I drink my four cups, I make sure to have a much smaller cup than I have when I make Kiddush at home on Friday night. Because the Kiddush at home on Friday night, maybe it's a nice thing to drink Rovkos or Kolakos, it's very good, but it's not on the same level as here, where you're actually, lahalacha, required to drink Rovkos. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a, whatever, 4 or 5 ounce cup, not a 15 ounce cup, because I want to make sure I can fulfill this din. I would prefer to drink the whole cup, because kulo is the best practice. Rubo is an okay practice. Lechatchila and b'diavad. So this is, I would say, the baseline in mitzvos. Now, Rav Schechter Shalita, Rav Herschel Schechter, has an essay where he develops this idea at length. It's published in this sefer called Ginas Egos, his third volume. Here he discusses how much of this is biblical and how much of it is rabbinic, which is not for our discussion today, but suffice it to say that there are many assume that this principle of lechatchila b'diavad exists even on a biblical level. But what I'd like to do now is take a step back and explain some of the development. Like, how did we get to this? And by going through a little bit of this process, of this historical understanding, we can understand a lot better why it is that when we call the rabbi, we get different answers every time we call him. You ever notice that? And some people find that annoying. You know, one woman, she calls the rabbi, she gets one answer. She's talking to her friend the next day, and she says, oh, I asked the rabbi this. She says, yeah, it's funny, the rabbi told me something else last week. So either the rabbi got confused, he can't remember what he told me last week, or there's some reason that he keeps giving different people different answers. Or the same person calls the rabbi one day, then he calls the rabbi the next day, gets a different answer. So how can that be? So a lot of that has to do exactly with this issue of lechatchila b'diavad. And again, we have to understand it now on a more sophisticated level. So I think the best way to articulate this is to understand that the Torah is not just one channel. We all know this, but we don't think about it in a developed way, in a sophisticated way often. The Torah operates on two channels, and this is what we need to think about. It operates on what we could call the Torah Shebichsav, and on this side we have the Torah Shebaalpeh. You have the written Torah and you have the oral Torah. Okay? The question is, when Moshe Rabbeinu stood at Sinai and he got two Torahs, he got a written text, a document of the five books, and then he also got a whole host of rules and regulations, tools, rabbinic tools of how to apply these laws. Why did he need both? Why didn't he just get a book with everything in it? Why not? Why did God ordain that there has to be a Torah Shebichsav and a Torah Shebaalpeh, a written and an oral? So there are many answers to this question. One of them might be that there is simply too much information, too vast of a corpus of knowledge that would exist for all time. But there is an even more nuanced approach, and that appears on the next page in the source packet on page 6. And this is the author. The author is known as the Dor Ravi. Dor Ravi means fourth generation. Why is it called the Dor Ravi? Because he's the fourth generation descendant of the Chassam Sofer, of Moshe Sofer, who was probably the most prestigious Hungarian Rav in the early first half of the 19th century. So his great-grandson, his name was Rav Moshe Shmuel Glasner. He was a rabbi in Transylvania in the early 20th century, and he asked the same question. He gives a very interesting answer. He says, Me'ata, mi she'eino rotza la'akim ha'emes yagia la'achlata. A person who doesn't want to obscure the truth will come to the conclusion, Shemashinimsar pirish ha'torah al-peh, v'nesar l'kosva, that which is traditionally orally transmitted, so much so, by the way, that in the old days it was forbidden to transmit this part, the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral tradition in writing, but that's for another day. Hu kedei shelo la'asosa kiyam l'dor doros, v'shelo likshor yidei chachmei dor v'dor l'farish haksuvim kefi havanasam. He says, wait a second. The Torah is eternal. The word Torah means what? Teach, but maybe more precisely, what is a moreh? A teacher and a guide. The word lahoros means to guide. So the Torah is a guidebook for life. Well, wait a second. We're living in the year 2014, and the Torah was given, I'm not good with math, so the Torah was given in the Hebrew year of 2448 when we left Mitzrayim, and we're now living in 5774. So 5774 minus 2448 is whatever. So however long ago that was, they didn't have airplanes. They didn't have assisted reproductive technologies. They didn't have cell phones. They didn't have copy machines. Says the Dor Ravi, he says, wait a second. If everything would have been only in Torah Shebichsav, the Torah would have been fossilized. Because we would be handcuffed. We wouldn't know how to apply, how to implement a Torah that was given 3,000 years ago in our lives in the year 2014. And therefore, he says, it was essential that along with a text would be given a bag of tools to interpret and apply and constantly reinterpret. Now, on some level, this changed after essentially the close of the Talmud. We don't have the same interpretive abilities, legal abilities, as we did, but the principle of the matter remains the same. How to apply that which is in a fixed text to a live situation. So how does this develop? So the rabbis had a whole group of tools, and they infer, they use these tools for reading between the lines of the text. So Moshe Rabbeinu received these principles, we'll call them the 13 principles, but there are really many more. There are more like 30 or 40 or 50 rabbinic principles of saying, okay, here's the text, how do I interpret it? So they're going to take these principles, they're going to pass them from generation to generation, and they're going to use this to interpret the Torah Shebichsav. Everything is fine and good. And not only that, you have a centralized authority, which is the Sanhedrin. So these are going to be the two key principles. The Sanhedrin, they are the ruling body in the Beis HaMikdash, and they decide. You have a question. Maybe your local rabbi doesn't know the answer. Or maybe you have a dispute between local rabbis. They're going to bring all the questions up to the Beis HaMikdash, and they're going to get one final adjudication.
And this is how they're going to deal with all the questions that come up over the course of generations. But it's going to get more complicated. Because in the days of Hillel and Shammai, so you're now talking in the last, you know, the last 200 years, approximately before the Common Era, you have an intense period of persecution. Not that we didn't have a lot of persecution before then, but we have an intense period of persecution. I'm skipping over, like, all of Jewish history on one foot, just to get to the point for us. So we know that in about 586 BCE, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Many of the Jews, most of the Jews, were taken to Babel, and many of them stayed there. So this became the period of the Second Temple, where there was a tremendous development of Torah Shebaal Peh, of the oral tradition during the Second Temple period, because of the lack of prophecy and the exile. Very fine and good. So everything still is staying very centralized with the Second Temple period. We've got the Anshei Knesset HaGadol, the men of the Great Assembly. All right, I'm really butchering Jewish history, but just to get to the point. In the times of Hillel and Shammai, they said, wait a second, here's our problem. We've got 13 principles, and everybody, over the course of generations, were analyzing the written text based on these principles. But the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, Shelo Shimshu Kol Tzarkam, they didn't see things the same way. The Rambam interprets that line as they didn't, the Talmidim of Hillel, the students of Hillel and the students of Shammai, they started looking at things with different methodological approaches. So whether that's because they were scattered because of growing persecution, whether that was because of internal struggles that they had, whatever it's because, that's not for the topic today. But all of a sudden now, there becomes, using these 13 principles, a differentiation within practices. Because you can use the same principles, but applying them differently, you'll come to a different conclusion. So, one example of this would be, for example, the Pasuk says, Los Vashel Gedi Bachalev Imo. Do not cook a kid in its mother's milk. Well, how do you interpret that verse if you're using rabbinic tools? Well, there are a lot of different ways to interpret it. How does it apply, for example, to chicken? Well, in a certain sense, a gedi is meat, and chicken is also meat, so maybe you should say it applies to chicken. On the other hand, a gedi has an aim, chalev imo, milk of its mothers, chickens don't nurse. So maybe it doesn't apply to chickens. So there is a Talmudic debate, a Mishnaic debate about this matter. And so on and so forth, that became, over the course of the development of the Mishnayos, particularly in the times after Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, we used to have zugos, we used to have pairs. Two rabbis, they led the Sanhedrin, and even after the Sanhedrin, without the Sanhedrin, there was a lot of centralized authority in many respects, but during the time of Hillel and Shammai, that's why probably many of the people in this room have heard about a debate between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. It happens to be Hillel and Shammai, they got along great rabbinically. They only had like 4 or 5 arguments between the two of them. But their students, they developed many arguments, countless arguments. So those arguments all develop here. Well, now we're starting to think about, wait a second, how does this, all of this, you know, information, how's this relevant to anything that we're talking about? Well, because what happens now is, because there is no more Sanhedrin, we have no more fixed one unified authority, because the Sanhedrin was disbanded 40 years before the destruction of Beis HaMikdash, approximately, and they were moved to the north of Israel, and then they just scattered. So now, wait a second, what do we do? Because we have two parts of Torah. We have Torah Shebichsav, and you have Torah Shebaal Peh. You have the written, and you have the oral. And now when it comes to the oral tradition, because it's open to rabbinic interpretation of the leading rabbis of the generation, we don't have uniformity anymore. Wait a second, different people are looking at it from different perspectives. So now, you have potentially multiple viewpoints. So you have the Mishnah that's going to record many debates. And then you have the Talmud, which is going to expand those debates and explain where did they come from. I just gave you an example of one of them, where you have a Mishnaic debate about whether this prohibition applies to chicken. Comes along the Talmud and Masechus Gittin says, I'll explain it to you. Let me explain to you why it is that they're debating. The problem is, even at the close of the Talmud, there isn't a clear resolution for many things. So we have a principle, Ravina Ravashi Sof Hora. Anything that is included in the Talmud, the Rambam says that is binding. Why? Because the Talmud was the last time where nearly, essentially, all of Jewish scholarship and study and spirit was in one location. After this close of the Talmud, then during the Gaonim, people are scattered all over the world. Okay, but very often things are not necessarily included in the Talmud as And what's the end resolution? So sometimes the Talmud will resolve what appears in the Mishnah, but what happens when you have a debate in the Talmud that goes unresolved? So you have a later period of sages. They're referred to as the Rishonim, the earliers. So the Rishonim, let's say we're talking between the 10th and the 15th or 16th century. So they're going to have different opinions as to what is the conclusion, what is the ruling that the Talmud is trying to tell us. And now you're starting to see how this can get dizzying. Because even sometimes you have a debate between Rishonim, especially between Sfaradim and Ashkenazim. So here we will split between Sfarad and Ashkenaz. So you're talking Sfarad, Spain, North Africa, not so much. Yemen is following the Ramah, so in a certain sense we'll call them Sephardic. Iraq, Morocco, all these places. And then you're talking about Ashkenazim, so he's talking about France, Germany, Eastern Europe, all these places. So now we can understand why there is a whole different story about best practices. Because earlier we spoke about best practices within the Torah Shebichtav. You know, multiple options within a mitzvah or multiple layers within a mitzvah. But now we're looking at something else. And that has to do with best practices of how to resolve the questions that exist within the rabbinic literature. Because the bottom line is you can't follow every opinion. I showed you an example before. The Rambam says that this is not the way to tie tchelas. The Rambam says you have one string. The Ravid, Rav Avram ben David of Poskier, he disputes the Rambam. He was a very important 13th century figure. He says the Rambam is wrong, because the Rambam thinks you only have half a blue string. So for example, you see here, the way that the strings are folded, it's four strings folded in half. So you have eight strings. According to Tosfos, which is the practice of some, you have four of the total eight, you have four blue strings. According to the Ravid, you have two, one on each side. According to the Rambam, you only have one. You can't follow everything. And what happens when they disagree about more fundamental issues? So here is a great example of where we think about, and this is the complexity of trying to identify best practices. And I'll give you one example of a million, but a kind of a small, tiny example on the next page, on page 7, in Hilchos Brachos example. And Tosfos himself gives you this. The case over here is talking about cooked kernels. It's a Hilchos Brachos question where you have, in this case, it's, let's say you took a pot and you made, not farina, because if it's farina, it's going to for sure be mizonos and it's going to be alamechia. But let's say you took a pot, you filled it with water, you just put in a few kernels of barley, and you cook them up and they're standing separately. So it's difficult to figure out what kind of bracha you're going to make on those things. Are they like eating barley from the ground? You know, maybe it's like a hadama, maybe it's like a mizonos. Even if it gets a mizonos, is it going to get an alamichya afterwards? So Tosfos makes the following suggestion. Tosfos, remember, is living in France, and Tosfos is not one person. Tosfos is a group of scholars, a group of great rabbis, and we believe, as we understand, that the authority of the scholars doesn't just come from their scholarship, it comes from their piety, and these are great people who we look up to, and we don't view ourselves in the same sphere. They're people. They make mistakes. They argue. But we're not in the same sphere. So Tosfos says, you know what? He has a suggestion. Says, I'm not sure what bracha to make on these things. So he says, V'nachon lahachmir. The best thing is to be stringent. She'ein lechol kloyos ochitim shalukos. Not to eat these kernels that are cooked. Ela besoch ha-se'uda. During a meal where you washed. So Tosfos, 800 years ago, is saying, here's an example of a best practice. We have a debate between rabbis. These rabbis are debating in the period of Rishonim what the halacha is. So you know what he says? The best practice is, don't get involved in a debate. Sometimes we're going to take sides. Sometimes we follow our tradition. And again, if you are of a specific community, you're going to be able to trace. And if we had all day, we could spend all day. I wouldn't leave. We could spend all day tracing all of our practices. I would venture to guess that most of the people in this room are Ashkenazim. We could trace our practice all the way from generations back through Ashkenazi practice to the Rishonim, the Talmud, the Mishnah, the 13 principles, right back into the Chumash. We could do that with no problem. Every single area of Halakha. But, Tosfos says, sometimes best practice means let's think about what others' viewpoint is. And maybe we could try to incorporate that into our practice as well. Here's another example. Turn the page. Now this might touch a raw nerve a little bit, but I've never had a tomato in the middle of a shear. Let's hope this. This is a piece of Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch is authored by Rav Yosef Karo. Here is another example of where
You know, authority and dissent is a good question. Shulchan Aruch is Rav Yosef Karo in the 16th century in Tzfat. He's Sephardic. He's basing many of his rulings on the Rambam. Primarily says the Rambam, the Rosh, and the Rif, not for today's discussion. Generally Sephardic. The Rav Moshe Isserles, the Ramah, he's living in Krakow, just about the same time, the turn of the 17th century, beginning of the 1600s. He has more of an Ashkenazi spin on things. Okay, here's the question. Kashering glass. What do you say? Can you kasher glass? Well, let's look in the Torah Shebichsav. In the Torah Shebichsav, in next week's parsha, we're going to talk about the laws of kashering. Parshas Matos. Because the Jewish people are going to fight against the Midianites, and they're going to bring home all these vessels, and everybody's like, oh, that's great, let's use them. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, you can't use them, you got to kasher them. So there's a whole discussion about kashering the vessels from Midian. But guess what? In the kashering of Midian, in the Torah Shebichsav, it doesn't say anything about glassware. It just talks about metal, different kinds of metal. So I'm thinking to myself, well, I'm going to use, if I was living 2,500 years ago, we're going to use the rabbinic principles and try to figure out what did the Torah mean when it came to glass. So the rabbis in the Gemara and the Mishnah have a discussion about klei zechuchis, about glassware for various different things, and then the Rishonim have a discussion about kashering glass. Can you remove the belios, the taste that's infused into the walls of a glass vessel, and take it out? So, when we get down here, Ashkenazim and Sephardim, what do you say? So the Shulchan Aruch tells you the following. In Siman Tofman Aleph in Hilchos Pesach, Kli Zechuchis, glass vessels, Afilu Machnison Lekiyum Va'afilu Mishtamish Behem Bechamin, even if you keep them for a long time, even if you use them in hot water, burning hot water on the stove, Ein Tzrichin Shum Hechsher, you don't need to kasher them at all. That's what he says. She'enam Bolim, they do not absorb. Now, the Shulchan Aruch didn't make this up. This comes from his tradition, from the Chachmei Sfarad. He quotes it earlier in the Beis Yosef, his commentary on the tour. A lot more discussion. This is one viewpoint. The viewpoint that says glassware never becomes treif because it doesn't absorb. Its substance is different. That's one viewpoint. But there is a very different viewpoint in another group of Rishonim, primarily Ashkenazi Rishonim, which we're not going to talk about now, although we can spend a few hours talking about them. Says the Ramah in the small script, V'yesh machmirim, and there are those who are more stringent, V'omrim, and they say, Deklei zechuchis, glass vessels, afilu hagola lo mahani lehu. Even boiling water doesn't help. Once they're treif, they're done. Toss it out. V'chein ha-minig ba'ashkenazu b'menino seinu. And that is the practice in Ashkenazi communities and in our country, says Ramah in Krakow. Why? What's the rationale for this? Because the earlier Rishonim suggest, well, very often, when I was a kid, we once took a field trip to a glass-blowing place. Many of these glass vessels are made out of sand. Well, sand and earth, the Gemara says, the kli cheres, earthenware vessels, it's nearly impossible to kasher them because they're very porous. So the Ashkenazi Rishonim, many of them say, wait a second, if the glass is derived from sand, so then we should view it categorically as sand vessels, and therefore you shouldn't be able to kasher them even if you wanted to. So here is a perfect example of a debate between one group of Rishonim and another group of Rishonim. So here comes the question, how do we practice? So perhaps we would say, best practice is you have a whole group of Ashkenazi Rishonim that say, don't kasher glass. Maybe the best practice would say, don't kasher glass. But this is where, once we understand the development of the halacha, and you have different Rishonim who are interpreting back, they're not reinterpreting the Chumash, they're just trying to understand what the Talmud taught us, so now we can understand the built-in flexibility in halacha. And I would suggest if we went back to the Dor Ravi, we would understand part of the reason why you need Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebalpeh is because you also need flexibility. What do I mean by that? What happens in Torah Shebichsav when you have a conflict? How do you resolve a conflict? I don't know. It doesn't say. Let's say in one place in Chumash, it says you have to put tcheles on your tzitzis. Okay? Tcheles comes from what material? The dye comes from the murex trunculus that we think. But where's it come from?
Chilazon.
Right, chilazon, murex trunculus probably. Not radzin or chsedim, they think it comes from something else. But what is the fabric of the blue strings? It must be, what? Wool. But what if you have a beged that is linen? I don't know. Does that? That's a question. I'm asking you. What are you asking me for? That's right. So that's a question. How do you know, esse tocha lo sese, that the positive commandment, what do you do? If all I had was a Torah Shebichtav, I'd sit there and say, I don't know. I have, on the one hand, I have a shirt that's made out of linen, a jacket's made out of linen. On the other hand, therefore, I can't put the shatness in it, I can't put the blue strings in it. On the other hand, you're telling me that I have to put the blues, I don't know how to resolve it. So there's a whole 5 pages in the Mesichas Yevamos that discusses what to do in that case. If you didn't have a Torah Shebaal Peh, you wouldn't be able to resolve the conflicts. There needs to be an understanding of a flexibility of how to deal with different circumstances. So in a certain sense, this is another example. And this is where, when we talk about best practices, you have a flexibility built in. And that's what we call Shas HaDchak. If you look on the next page, this is a tshuva from one of the great rabbinic luminaries from before Europe. He lived in Lithuania. He was essentially, after the death of the Chavetz Chaim in 1933, Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski. He was the most influential rabbi in all of Europe, and he has a shaila that comes up very often, Allah Kalamaisa, and those who went to Israel over the past many years used to have this question very often, because Israel doesn't have a lot of land and a lot of livestock. The shaila is what we call, and this is in his tshuva, it's called Achiezer. Again, this is Lithuania before the war. He died just before the Nazis destroyed Jewish life in Vilna. Bidin basar kafu. What does the word basar kafu mean? Frozen meat. So here's the story. So we live in Chicago, which is great because this is the meat capital of the Midwest, at least according to Upton Sinclair and many old schlachtoys, and it used to be the case. So the rule is, when you slaughter meat, if you don't want to grill it, you want to just put it in the chalet, you have to salt it. Some of these people in this room actually maybe remember, actually, people who actually did this, but I can't say that was during my lifetime. So you remember salting the meat. But the halacha is, the din is, that you have to salt the meat within 72 hours. You have to salt the meat within 72 hours. Otherwise, the blood that you're trying to remove by the process of salting is going to be essentially rooted in the meat. So let's say you have shochtim who are out there somewhere in Iowa or some other state, Nebraska, and they're shechting meat out in the middle of nowhere. And then you have people sitting in the Lower East Side who are waiting for their chalent meat. So they have to take their meat by refrigerated train car from Nebraska to the people in New York. So what would they do? So you have to, the halacha is, you have to wash the meat. If you wash the meat, you restart the clock. So in Chicago, in the old days, they would have the cattle cars come in, they would hose down the meat, then they would take it further. So you wouldn't have 72 hours that would elapse from when the animal was shechted until the butcher is going to salt the meat in the Lower East Side. But what if you're living in Israel or some other place and you don't have that mechanism? It's not so easy. In the place where they're shechting the meat, for some whatever reason, they don't have the capacity to salt the meat there. So someone came up with the following einfallen, the Acharonim, already over 100 years ago. What about freezing the meat? What if you freeze it right now after you shecht it? Can you stop the clock? Export it, send it from Argentina, wherever they're shechting the animals, send it to Israel, defrost it, and wash it and salt it. What's the halacha? So Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski was asked about this shaila. So he says, in the bracket, he quotes a dispute between the authorities. B'mikre shebidieved. Post facto, the meat that you have was frozen? Hayisi no talahatir. I would be lenient. However, he says furthermore, b'che'en zegam b'medina seinu, in our country. Ulam, however, etzlam, in that place where he's discussing, dahave shas hadchak gadol, it's a great case of need, yesh lodun bezeh kidieved. A case of great need is the equivalent of bidieved, of post facto. And therefore he says, va'al kein yesh lismoch lahakel af lechatchila. So yes, on the one hand, we strive for living lives of lechatchila, but we need to know, sometimes there's lechatchila, and sometimes there's bidieved. And you have to know that there's flexibility there. And sometimes, b'shas hadchak, in a case of dire need, of great need, sometimes they call in halacha, hefsin meruba. So hefsin meruba, we go from lechatchila, we treat it as bidieved, even a priori. So this is why sometimes you'll call the rabbi, and the rabbi will say, okay, you want to talk about kashering your kelim for Pesach? Kashering your glass vessel? So let's go back to page 8 and see what the Chafetz Chaim says in the bottom. He says, if you're Ashkenazi, the rabbi will tell you, look, Generally, we tell people, follow the Machmirim, the Ashkenazim. But you know, there are many great Sephardic poskim, many great Rishonim. So we would say, that's not l'chatchila. However, we said, b'di'eved, if they did that, you're okay. Not only that, we just learned from the Achiezer a very important principle in halacha, that shas hadchak, case of need, it's like post facto. So if it's good b'di'eved, if it's okay post facto, you can use it in shas hadchak. Just 1 second. So therefore, says the Chofetz Chaim in the bottom in the Mishneh Berurah, in Kuf Nun Vav, he quotes me, "Komakum b'makum she'ein b'nimtzamon," the right hand side of the page on page 8, second column toward the bottom, "B'makum she'ein b'nimtza kleis chuchis," in a place where you can't, it's not like today where you could go face Crane Barrel or TJ Maxx or wherever you go to buy a glass. You gotta get whatever. In those days, it's not so easy. "Ein lo koso sushar keim," they didn't have anything else. He's writing in the 18th century in Lithuania. He says, "Kos of a chayodom." The chayodom writes, "De yachol lismoch lahokel." You can't be lenient. And then he goes through the whole method of kashering the glass vessels. So you call the rabbi. The rabbi's thinking in his head. He's saying, "Wait a second. Lechatchila, go get another couple of glasses. But the evidence, if you kashered it, so then we'll figure it out." But the question is, well, where do you draw the line? So you have to know. That's why we ask rabbis. We don't ask Google. You ask rabbis because the rabbis have been trained with an appropriate methodology of knowing what are these different strata. How do you know what's l'chatchila and b'di'eved? According to whom? We can't make those decisions on our own. We need to call rabbis. And the more serious shilas, the rabbis will often forward those to greater rabbis, worldwide authorities. But this is a good example of the flexibility that's built into the Torah Shebaal Peh. We want to do everything l'chatchila, but it's not always possible. What I'd like to close with is one other segment that makes it even more complex. And now we go to page 10. I'd like to ask you, if you were to imagine Hillel HaZaken, Hillel the Elder, would you think he's a pious man? What would you say? Anybody who votes for yes on the piety scale for Hillel HaZaken, just one hand. Make sure everybody's still awake here. Most people, yes. According to the tradition, he basically throws on the top of a roof so he could be able to learn in the Beis Medrash, even though he was too poor to afford the entrance fee. So Hillel made the following enactment. He created what's called a prizbul. Prizbul is very important for this coming year, because this coming year is Shemitah. So Rabbi Avad Yosef writes in the Tshuva, we assume that Shemitah cancels debts at the end. Okay? There is a principle in the Torah that says that on Shemitah all debts are canceled. Rabbi Avad Yosef says that means at the end of Shemitah. Well, imagine I took out a bank loan for $500,000. And then at the end of next year, at the end of the Shemitah year, I come to the bank and I'm like, hope you're doing well. I'd like to give you a bottle of wine and thank you for my house. I'd be like, what's a bottle of wine for? Well, I don't have to pay back the debt anymore because Shemitah just canceled out all the debts. So do you think the bank is going to lend me money the next time I come knocking? Yeah, right. No. So Hillel came up with the following suggestion. He created what's called a prizbul. Ze echad me'advarim, on page 10. Hillel Hiskin prizbul. Hillel instituted a prizbul. Ze echad min advarim shehiskin Hillel zazokin. Why? Shera es ha'am shenimlu milahalvos. People stopped lending zeze. Va'avru al mashakosu batorah hishomer lecha pen yeh davar in levavcha b'lial. Omar v'hiskin prizbul. Hillel saw people weren't going to lend. The economic system was frozen. So what did he do? He instituted the prizbul. So I ask you, is a prizbul l'chatchila? A prizbul is a device, which we're not going to talk about how it works, that says, don't worry, I'm going to give your loan. I'm going to take these documents, give them to rabbinic court, and the rabbis are going to go and collect the loan. So at the end of the day, you got to pay. So is that l'chatchila or b'di'eved? Well, you could tell me, b'di'eved, that's not best practices. Best practices is everybody loans, everybody forgives. So you're going to tell me that Hillel was a mekel. So on one hand, you could tell me that Hillel was a mekel. On the other hand, you could tell me he was a machmir. He was very stringent. Why? You're right, he was lenient about the laws of Shemitah, but he was very machmir about the laws, the mitzvah of loaning money. The most complex area of l'chatchila and b'di'eved is when you have competing values. What needs to guide us, and this is what we started this year with, is we want to be what Rabbi Michael Rosenzweig Shliti likes to call religious maximalists. We want to do the best for the Dvar Hashem. But that has to be done in reality. And if the reality is that people aren't lending, well, now you have a choice. You have to weigh multiple variables. And the answer is that l'chatchila in one situation is b'di'eved in a different, and vice versa. Sometimes what's best in one is, you know, some people, And I tend to agree with this approach. Some people, when anything happens in a medical question on Shabbos, they immediately get in the car and they drive to the hospital. If that's what they would do on Tuesday, that's what they're supposed to do on Shabbos. They're very punctilious about that. So what are you going to say? They're very makel in Hilchos Shabbos. Yeah, they're makel in Hilchos Shabbos, but they're machmir in the laws of Achai Bohem, in Pikuach Nefesh. What is a kula in one place is a chumra somewhere else. What is lachatchila in one instance is a bidievet somewhere else. I'll give you another example. On the next page, on page 11, we're not going to have time, we're already over time, I want to finish in the next 2 minutes. Rav Shaul Yisraeli, the great rabbi, scholar, tremendous, prodigious authority, Rav Shaul Yisraeli has the following shaila that was sent him by fax to his kol Eretz Chemda on page 11 from Ecuador, Tuf Shinun Dalit. They said, wait a second, we have a problem. We're going to get produce for Shemitah next year, and there are certain products that many farmers in Israel, they're not going to observe Shemitah. So the state of Israel relies on a certain leniency called Heter Mechira. We could spend all day talking just about that. So they say, 1 second, we want to be Lachatchila. And Rav Kook already wrote that Heter Mechira is B'dievet. It's not ideal. On the other hand, he says, what's our other option? We should buy produce from Arab farmers. Well, which is better? So this is an ongoing debate. So one person will tell you, you should be machmir not to buy heter mechira. But other people will say, yeah, if you're going to be machmir not to buy heter mechira, you're going to be makel on supporting certain elements, which we're not going to go into at this moment, certain farmers, lo sechanim. Maybe there's an issur to allow non-Jews to live in Israel in the first place. Now, practically, that's not the case, Bisman Azeh, for a whole host of reasons, not for discussion today. But wait a second. You have two questions. Which is lachatchila? In a certain sense, they're both lachatchila, and they're both b'dieved. And in consonance with the rabbi, who's going to help you figure out to paskin the shaila for you in your unique situation. Similar question comes up all the time regarding family issues, right? Husband and wife, there are questions of Hilchos Nida. So, very often, there Hilchos Nida, there are many different debates, especially Sfaradim and Ashkenazim and Rishonim. Well, you could say sometimes you're going to be machmir when it comes to the laws of Nida, various questions. But you know what's on the other side? Sometimes the mitzvah of peruavu, having children. Sometimes it's the mitzvah of ona, spending time together. Sometimes it's the mitzvah of shalom bayis. So to determine lachatchila and b'dieved in these cases requires the expertise of a rav muvuk, of a posik, to be able to weigh and balance those examples. And finally, one last example on page 13. We're not going to see it inside, but here's another question of balancing lachatchila. The main thing to keep in mind here is we're searching for the Dvar Hashem. That's why we're all here. We're all Lachatchila Jews. We want to do the best thing. We want to do the best thing. So we need to get the rabbinic guidance to figure that out. It's a story. I'm not going to read it inside. It's Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, the great posik of Yerushalayim. He died only 15 years ago. So man comes to Kol Torah. He's not observant. He arrives in the summertime in Rav Shlomo Zalman's yeshiva in Beit Vagan. So he comes to Kol Torah and the din is in Shulchan Aruch. We have to know. The halach is, it's beferish in Shulchan Aruch, that there is an issur of lifnei iver, of causing somebody to violate an avera because of me. I can't give a nazir a cup of wine if he can't get it anywhere else. And there are many aspects of this. So Shulchan Aruch says, if somebody comes to my home, and I know they're not going to make a bracha because they're not observant, I may not give them food. I may not give food to somebody who won't make a bracha. If I'm not mistaken, I believe with the kolos now in the summer in Skog Yeshiva, I think there's a sign in the dining room. I think the sign says something like, it's also lahachel, somebody's not going to make a bracha. It's a reminder, everybody has to make a bracha. So a man comes to Kol Torah, this is the story, and it's the dead of summer, it's burning hot, and Rosh Hashanah tells one of the bachrim to please bring a cup of water for this man. So the bachrim asked him afterwards, how could you give this man a drink? You know he's not observant. You know he's not going to make a bracha. So Shlomo Zalman has a landmark tshuva on the topic of lifnei iver. He says, look, we're going to go lachatchila, right? But you have to weigh. On the one hand, you have the lachatchila of causing the person not to make a bracha, but you also have the lachatchila of not causing the person to hate Jews, to hate the Torah, to hate B'nai Torah, to hate the yeshiva, the world of yeshivas. So Shlomo Zalman says, it's better, it's more lachatchila to give the person a drink that he shouldn't make a bracha, that he should walk away and say, ah, feh, look at how these observant Jews treat other people. So this summary, and you can look in the last page, I shared it for you just in a quick outline form, this is the way that we could begin the conversation for us in this room as incredible, inspired, growing, aspirational Jews. We're all looking for Lechatchila. And we know that Lechatchila is important for us because we want to develop our relationship with Hashem. We want to strengthen that cord. So we need to know, when is it Lechatchila b'di'eved? When is it that there are multiple components of a mitzvah? When is it that there are multiple layers? And then we're going to understand, when we call the rabbi, we're going to know that there are multiple components when it comes to a question between various different poskim. And we're going to try to strive to do our best in the complex life in which we live for religious maximalism. Always striving to be Lechatchila. And understanding that part of the process of living a Lechatchila life means making decisions, making choices. Our hope is that we ask for Siyata Dishmaya, that God should always help us, that we should do the best we can and make a Kiddush Hashem wherever we go. Thank you very much. Okay. We are running a few minutes behind schedule. We're going to take a 5-minute break. The next sessions will begin at 10:02. Rabbi Dov Lerner, the murmuring deep biblical subtlety and midrashic insight, the right hand side. This is Tema Taxer, Mrs. Zamalka Sinkovich. Any more handouts?